So, Angela.
Yes, Catherine.
What is one thing you are particularly looking forward to doing this year, 2021?
Right now, I'm obsessed with touching people. I fantasize about it. Like, I got a little preview because I got to hug and kiss my mother and father. But now I'm like, I want to see my friends. I want to, you know, get their consent and then kiss them on the mouths. I want to go to a dance party. I want to brush up against strangers. I'm feeling this kind of like platonic horniness, I guess. What about you, Catherine? What are you looking forward to?
I am looking forward to a multi-hour indoor dinner party with passing the dishes around, everybody sharing things, and then the kids are in the other room doing something and you don't care. Yeah. Just all, a big pile of kids in there just doing
You're
something.
Collectively ignoring them.
Yes.
Yes.
While you have a nice dinner party with adults. That's what I'm looking forward to.
Yeah. No, that's that sounds amazing.
This is The Double Shift, the show that challenges the status quo of motherhood. I'm your host, Catherine Goldstein.
And I'm your co-host, Angela Garbez.
The reason I asked you about what you were looking forward to is I do feel like we're in this moment where, like, it does feel like many things are going to get better this year. Like, I don't want to jinx anything, but it feels like we're coming out of some very, very dark times.
Yeah, this strange feeling of hope that I have, that I actually am able to trust a little bit.
Right.
But I also think that part of the transition right now is also coming to terms with what's happened to us in the past year. Just because we get to go on vacation or hug our parents and grandparents doesn't mean by any means that we're healed from the personal and collective trauma of the pandemic.
Yeah. I mean, I think we just have to be honest that it's not going to be a snap of the fingers to recover from what we've gone through this year. And I mean, how do we even start to get our heads around it? I mean, the emotional toll, the grief.
Yeah, the grief is overwhelming.
Yeah.
Right. And that's exactly why we wanted to do today's episode, to start to be able to wrap our minds around how we come to terms with all that we've lost and what has happened over the last year.
Magizio de Kwe Dijnakaz, Pagwashin Donjaba Nishnabe Kwe Indao Makwadodem. My name is Andrea Landry. I come from a small community in northwestern Ontario called Paceblatt, but we call it Pagwashin in our mother tongue. I currently reside on Powmaker Cree Nation. It's in Saskatchewan, Canada, colonially named.
Andrea teaches at First Nations University in their Indigenous Social Work Program. She's also a life skills coach and a freelance writer.
And she's an activist whose advocacy is infused in every part of her life, including motherhood.
So we came across her blog and Twitter account that has so many interesting perspectives on her personal experiences, but also her thinking about collective grief and trauma that her Native community has been grappling with for generations. So we wanted her expertise on the emotional experiences so many of us are going through, but also how they tie into larger political issues and why, especially for mothers, dealing with the emotions of the past year is about more than just a, you know, personal thing. It's actually essential to our political liberation.
Yes. And this is a really fascinating idea we're going to get into with her. We wanted to talk to Andrea in this moment to start a conversation about grief and how we start to process it.
So Andrea lives with her 4-year-old daughter, RJ, and her partner, Colby, and they have been living in pretty strict isolation in the last year when we spoke with her, especially to help protect elderly relatives they are close with.
Andrea says a saving grace during these rough times has been access to the land.
Yeah, so this is a really, really big reserve. My reserve back home, where I live in northwestern Ontario, where I'm from, has 90 people on reserve. Our houses are right side by side. It's literally a cul-de-sac off the highway. This community, when I first moved here, I was blown away because it's kilometers long. Houses are so spread out. Like, we have a horse pasture, we have horses, we have, you know, the ability to go for a walk for 3 kilometers and you won't come in contact with anybody. And that's how we're very, very lucky in that. And so, yeah, it's been, for me, it was quite different moving here, seeing how spread out and isolating it is, because you don't see people, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
That's interesting, because so many people are experiencing isolation right now, even if they are living in a dense apartment building. I mean, I think, and so thinking about this, this has been sort of a time of not only isolation, but really a time of tremendous loss for so many people. In a way, I think we aren't really talking about and processing enough. And I was wondering, what has been your experience of, you know, grief in your life, and how is that informing how you are seeing what's happening right now with so many people finding or needing to find ways to grieve?
It's been hard with COVID. We've lost a relative, one of Colby's uncles from the States. He passed away from COVID. We've had health complications from family members due to COVID. And what I've found is that during isolation, a lot of stored emotions are doing their best to come out, regardless of if we're attempting to shove them down deeper or if we're unaware of it. And so the reality is, there's no other choice for me but to face what I have to face, what I've been ignoring. And so in my life, you know, grief has been huge. And you can go to any Indigenous community. And I used to work in public schools on reserve, and I used to talk about grief with children. And as young as grade 2, I would ask them the question, how many of you have a loved one in heaven? Every child in that class will raise their hand. Some will say, I have 2, or I have 3, or I have 4. It's their moms, it's their dads, it's their uncles, it's their aunties, and it's their siblings. So a lot of children in our communities are struggling with high profile losses. And that was the reality. And so for me, I lost my mom five and a half, almost 6 years ago now. And I lost my brother to suicide 3 years ago. And it was these back-to-back griefs that seem to happen all the time. It's like, it's never just one, you know, it always has to be more than one. And for me, I was pregnant when I lost my mom, and she died from a ruptured brain aneurysm suddenly. Her and I were best friends. We repaired our relationship to the point where we could be best friends. And for me, there's this teaching that the baby that I'm carrying could hear every thought I was hearing and feel every feeling I'm feeling. And I knew that when I was pregnant with my daughter. And I knew that if I didn't allow my grief to come out, that my baby would carry it and it would be ingrained in her DNA. And so as I was going through the grieving process of my late mom, I felt it as often as I could. So sitting in the bathtub, having full-on conversations with my mom, sitting on the kitchen floor, the first time I made spaghetti after she died, because she was the one who taught me how to make spaghetti when I was a kid. And feeling all that came with that, and all these little triggers, even before COVID, like crying in a grocery store because her favorite song was playing and this woman walked by who smelled exactly like my mom. And I was like, what? And I was sobbing in the grocery store. And so for me, it's like allowing myself to feel regardless of where I am, regardless of who's watching. Even in front of my daughter, the grief still comes up. When my late brother committed suicide, it was like I grieved openly in front of her, and I would just say, I miss my brother, or I miss my mom, they're in heaven right now, and I would cry. And so it was showing her, you know, healthy ways to grieve openly. So grief has played a huge role in my life, and I know it will continue, because that's life and death is a major part of our existence. And for me, it's just about dealing with it in the healthiest way that I can.
I love what you said. It was such an elegant way of saying it, that those big feelings in grief, they do their best to find their way out.
Yeah.
Right? I think that's a really interesting way of saying that. It's very generous towards the emotions, right?
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, I want to talk a little bit more about this process, though. I mean, it's a very difficult, I can't even imagine, you know, to lose your mother, and especially that you were at a place where you had done a lot of work to repair that relationship, yeah. right? And then to lose her while you were pregnant would be, you know, I imagine that's devastating. And that idea of wanting to, you write really beautifully about releasing grief, how that is really everything, because the grief wants to come out. But it's interesting, this idea that you want to release it because you know if you keep it inside, that fetus, that baby is affected by it. But then the emotion, she's going to be affected by it no matter what.
Yeah, for sure.
So then you find the way to deal with that. But I feel like you have something to say here about the process of grieving while also mothering.
Yeah. So when RJ was smaller, and even now, there was this societal belief ingrained in me as a mother that hide your sadness, even hide your anger as a mother. Don't show your child your vulnerability. And so often you see it in society where mothers are forcing themselves to hide in bathrooms and closets to feel their feelings rather than openly expressing their feelings in front of their children. And for me, when that feeling came, it was like, well, why do I have this belief? And I had to do some deep self-inquiry. And it came down to, I was never exposed to healthy ways of feeling feelings when I was a child.
Yeah.
And so my mother's rage, my mother's trauma, my mother's sadness from the intergenerational impacts of residential schools, from colonization, from all these things that have happened to our people, she in turn was never raised with how to healthily feel emotions. And so for me, the next question was, well, how can I express my emotions in a healthy way? And my partner introduced me to something called journey work. You could look it up. It's by Brandon Bays and Kevin Billett. And they've created these processes where it's simply about just feeling the emotions without the stories. And so for me, it was like, if I have rage, yesterday I had rage in my body. And full disclosure, my partner and I weren't getting along. And I felt all this rage come up. And for me, my first exposure to rage as a child was like through abuse and trauma. And I'm breaking those cycles. So for me, it's like, what do I need to do to feel this rage? And it's like, I'm going to sit on the floor and I'm just going to let my body vibrate. Mm-hmm. And my daughter's standing there watching. And I'm like, I'm just feeling my anger, baby. It's okay. You know, and she'll mm-hmm. create that space. She'll go play. She doesn't take it personally. She doesn't think it's her responsibility to fix me. I'm like, it's mm-hmm. my responsibility to feel through this. And I'm doing it in a safe way, in a healthy way. And so now what we're witnessing with her is when she has a feeling, she'll say, I just need to feel my feelings. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, what do you need to do to feel it in a safe way? And she'll do it. She'll either cry, or sometimes she yells, or sometimes she just stands there and goes, ah, like how I do it. It's like, I'm a witness. I've become the frame of reference for her to healthfully, in a healthy way, express emotions. And that's my goal.
I wondered, in terms of, you know, when we're talking about loss and grief, there's something that you wrote that's really stuck with me. And I think it's really applicable to this time in the pandemic. And obviously you lost your mother and you were grieving that before the pandemic happened. But you wrote about how you just, like, it's amazing how much you want to touch. You miss that touch and you need that, like, you feel that in your body, in your skin. And I just wondered if you could talk about what that's like now.
Yeah, I think it's automatic human need, like a biological need for physical touch. And I'm lucky I have my partner and my daughter, you know, for hugs and whatever else. And there's this thing that I've been noticing where whenever I went home, it was like this instant connection to my late mom and late brother every time, even though they're not there physically. It's like I go to my home community and it's like they're here still. You know, I can still keep in touch with them. And so I think the biggest thing for me has been not being able to go home and physically connect with our homeland and not being able to physically connect with that part of me. As Indigenous peoples, we see land as kin. You know, land is our family. Land is my relative and I treat it accordingly. When I go outside, I talk to the plants, I talk to the trees, my daughter does the same. And when I'm in my homeland, it's like I'm meeting, reuniting with my kin as soon as I see that lake, Lake Superior. And so when I go home and not being able to access that, there's this deep, deep longing inside where I long to reconnect. I long to sit with my cousins and laugh with them. I long to sit with my aunties and uncles and go fishing and do all the things that we do out there and feel the touch of the land on the bottoms of my feet, on the soles of my feet, or feel my hands brush against the lake water or the ice. And the reality is I can't do that. And I've grieved it, and I have been grieving it, and I cry about it. And I tell RJ, I miss going home. I miss my family. I miss the ability to bond with my family. Like, I'm so far away. I'm so far away over here. Because she misses my homelands too. She talks about it every day. When can we go to Pacebutt? Oh, we'll go when the virus is gone. Hey, Mom. We've done vision boards. So we do vision boards every year. And the first thing she put on the vision board was for the year was go to Pacebutt, because she wants to go so bad. And I'm like, I know, I want to go too. Like, I miss it so much. And so it's like finding a way to make do in the meantime, right?
So one of the things that I keep thinking about, that image of when you were pregnant with your daughter sobbing in the grocery store, as like that was just what you needed to do in the moment and to feel your feelings. And then juxtaposing that with, so often mothers don't give themselves that space and support. And I'm just wondering, you know, what would happen if we stopped managing our emotions? Like, what is a world where mothers aren't feeling like all they can, the only thing they can do for themselves is to, quote, manage their emotions?
We'd feel more liberated. We'd see more liberated mothers out there. We as mothers have learned these behaviors from our mothers and our mothers' mothers, where, yeah, it's important to put our families first. It's important to do the things that we do daily. And your family won't fall apart if you take 10 minutes to let out your feelings safely. Yeah, your family will still carry on. They'll be okay. And you'll feel a lot better, because you'll come out there and you'll be like, yeah, I'm ready to go again. Like, yes, this is awesome. I always feel like I'm floating on a cloud after I let out my rage and sadness in healthy ways. And then all of a sudden I'm ready to go play with my daughter again and really engage, rather than this pseudo play that I do with her when my emotions are stuffed in my body. Yet when I allow myself to feel my feelings, even if I know that supper has to be made, or I know that the house has to be cleaned because I only have 15 minutes to clean the house today because of everything else, it's like, it's all right if the house is a bit messy. What's important is I need to feel. And I tell my daughter, I need to feel. Can you give me a couple of minutes? I need to feel. And she knows. And she's the same. I need to feel. I'm like, okay, feel that. Awesome. Beautiful. Yeah, it's awesome.
I mean, I love this idea too, that if mothers let go of feeling the need to manage our emotions, we all smiled as soon as you said that, Catherine. All three of us were like, oh yeah. That what we would have is this feeling of liberation. And so I kind of want to jump on that and talk about, you know, on our show, we talk so much about collective values and action and how important that is, and know how necessary it is to challenge just like the dominant, and especially in the United States, this culture of individualism. And I think there's something to me, it's like if people felt more liberated and we didn't manage our emotions, we would also talk about them more and we would recognize them in other people, even at a distance, you know, so there would be this sort of shared experience that's easier to tap into, right? And certainly COVID makes all of that more relevant. So I wondered if you could talk about that. Are you seeing or are you sensing changes in conversation and our perception of collectivity and the importance of shared values and action?
Yeah. So prior to colonization, in our traditional kinship systems, we had these structures in place and these teachings ingrained in us where new mothers were never alone, where people who have lost a loved one were never alone. There were people cooking, there were people taking care of the children. There was always someone there. Yet colonization came and capitalism, patriarchy, all sexism, all these other things. And a lot of the time, mothers are left to fend for themselves, regardless of their circumstances and situations. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's been a challenge in recognizing, especially during COVID, like we can't go support the new mom. I'm sure we could, you know, we could bake a dish and drop it off at their front doorstep and, you know, do all these little things. But the reality is it's really challenging to get back to that collective way of living.
Okay, so going back to before she became a mom, Andrea was involved in movements to improve conditions and services for Indigenous communities in Canada.
She's made the choice not to use the word decolonize to describe her work, and we wanted to know how her Indigenous values are present in how she thinks about social and public policy.
9 or 10 years ago, I was at the UN. I was advocating for Indigenous rights. I was meeting with Stephen Harper, the Prime Minister at the time, pushing these different Indigenous agendas. And I realized you can't change colonial systems because they're founded on colonial beliefs. So regardless of how many times I begged for clean drinking water, regardless of how many times I begged for help for suicide epidemics in our communities, I wasn't going to get an answer from them. And so for me, it was like, yeah, we can't change how these systems perceive and operate because these systems are working for them. These systems are working for them, and that's how they were intended and designed. So for me, it's not about putting energy into colonial systems to change and dismantle them. For me, it's about putting energy and investing time and energy into Indigenous systems and revitalizing them in different ways. And so I'm not going to waste energy on decolonizing an institution. I'm going to spend all my time and energy in showing RJ how to grow her own food, how to learn her language. So her and her dad are taking Cree classes every Tuesday online because he didn't learn it. They're learning their mother tongue. You know, mine is Anishinaabemowin and it's a different language. They're pretty similar though. So that's where I've really placed my energy because I burnt myself out too many times, you know, crying around at the UN. It wasn't doing anything. So for me, it's like the little actions that add up. It's like me and RJ, we snare rabbits out in the bush. Snaring season is over now because the rabbits are mating and we don't want to kill mama bunnies. But during the winter time, it's what we do. And we usually only get one or two. And I believe that that's because we don't actually need that food to survive. Mm-hmm. So when we get that meat, we bring it to our Colby's auntie and uncle who love rabbit soup. You know, and it's like, we brought this for you. And they love it because mm-hmm. that's the stuff they grew up on when they were kids. And it looks like these little tiny ways of helping that add to the collective. Because there were times in my life when I was in my grief and when Colby was away for work and RJ was a newborn and I was alone for days on end. Not only was I suffering from postpartum depression, suffering from grief, like there were days where it was like, how the hell did I make it out alive? Like that was insane. Like what the heck? And, for me, it's like we've lost that sense of collectivity, yet we're doing our best to make that collective still exist. And so it's like showing RJ that we still have to take care of our relatives, even if we can't visit them in tiny ways, be there for them, support them. Yeah. And so it's just about getting creative in our solutions.
Did you ever have any experiences when you were a new mom about struggling with reaching out to ask for help and even knowing all these things, like sometimes even we can think we're going to do things one way or they're going to be one way and that's not the reality. Could you share a story about that experience for you?
Yeah. I think for me, that's still my struggle. It's always been asking for help has been my struggle. And the self-inquiry, the question that came like, well, what's stopping me? And for me, it's shame. It's shame of unworthiness, of not being able to say out loud that I can't do it alone. And it's like, I can't do it alone. Like, and that's okay. But for me, it was like avoiding that shame completely by not asking for help. and then in turn suffering, right? And so for me, it's been a way of maneuvering through that. And so an example of that, my daughter, she breastfed till she was 3.5, and she was up every 2 hours, literally for 3.5 years. And oh, no. I was working and I'm like, oh, how am I doing this? And my partner would be gone for work and it would just be me and her. And some days I was so exhausted some days that I would start like seeing little hallucinations. That's how tired I was. And it was in those moments where it was like, I need help. And so because it was pre-COVID times, thankfully, I was able to, my mother-in-law, she was really busy with work. She had just lost her husband, right? So she's in her grief too. And I give her so much credit because she would come over for an hour, even in her heavy grief, the love of her life. She lost the love of her life. And she would come over to this new love of her life, you know, this little baby. And let me hold her. You go rest. And I'd have that hour. And sometimes that hour is like the miracle cure. It's like, oh my God, I feel like a brand new mom. Right. And so for me, it was like letting go of the shame of not being able to do it and being incompetent. And sometimes that shame still shows up. And I say, hey, shame, I recognize you. I see that you're here. I'll feel you. And then I'm going to ask for help.
You know, something that I have been thinking about in this last year, I mean, I'm still thinking about this idea of recognizing shame and calling it out, and I just think that's so powerful. But I feel like so much of our experiences in the last year have felt backwards or upside down. Like, I hear just nonstop from moms about how they are drowning, and it's work, it's virtual school, it's losing income, it's health concerns, it's mental health concerns. And, you know, there's a sense of they want to know how to handle it all. Like, how do I handle this, you know? And I personally think so much of what mothers have been asked to do over the last year plus is not handleable. Like, it's not a thing that can be handled.
It's not.
And it wasn't working before the pandemic, and like, full stop, it's not working now. So, you know, we're not an advice show that tells mothers anything about, you know, how to live their best lives or be their best selves or anything like that. But I feel compelled to ask you, how do you think we can flip ourselves back? Or like, maybe a better way to say this is, how do we flip ourselves to where we could have been in thinking about and reacting to what is being asked of mothers right now?
Yeah, that's a tough question. Because when you were going through that list, I smiled because, yeah, I do homeschool for my daughter. I work. I teach 5 classes. I cook. My partner helps with the cooking and cleaning, thankfully, and he's also working, which is great. I'm having health issues. So all these things are accumulating, right? And it's like there's this expectation for us to do the best that we can. And some days I can't. I literally can't. So yesterday afternoon was really tough. And I emailed my class. I said, I'm not feeling good. I'm having a bad day. Class is canceled. And for me, what I've noticed is that a lot of women in particular are being 100% authentic in saying, I can't do it. I mentally can't do it. I physically can't do it. So there's no more of this pseudo falseness or this fakery that we are superheroes and we can do everything. Mm-hmm. And it's like, we still have our superhero capes. But I feel like that they're even bigger now because we've become more authentic in the truth of I can't do it all. And it's beautiful. It's profound because for me, I was taught with not having to expose my weaknesses. And for my daughter, I want her to recognize that exposing your weaknesses can bring liberation to your life. And it's like, it's okay to say I can't do it. I have 3 emails that have been sitting in my inbox for a week, and I'm like, I don't have the power right now to respond. And when I do respond, I'm going to say that, like, I'm struggling right now. And right. So even on Twitter, I've noticed women tweeting, like, I responded to my boss today that I just can't get out of bed today. And that's my truth. Rather than, oh, I have errands to run or I have an appointment. It's like mothers are now being 100% authentic and truthful. And there is, the reality is that's okay. There's power there. I think that it's beautiful.
So I love what Andrea said, but I want to acknowledge that not all of us are able to speak out in quite the same way. The reality is that some mothers don't have the option to call in sick or take some personal time. The financial risks might be too high. And some might not be ready or feel safe to express themselves in this way, in their homes or our personal lives. But I do really think that for many of us, and I think there's many of us who are realizing this, the risk is less than the reward. And that reward is feeling less alone and being able to stand in solidarity with other women.
So if, like Andrea, we can speak up about what we're going through personally and emotionally, that is really powerful. And maybe it can make things easier down the road for those who come after us. I mean, I'm just obsessed with the idea and the power of what would happen if mothers, like, stopped worrying about inconveniencing people, like, with our emotions, you know? Like, sorry, not sorry to spouses, bosses, coworkers, and everyone. Like, we have needs, and our needs are not a problem. Like, that they're just, we have the right to have them. And so, you know, I just, this idea that feeling our feelings and being in touch with them is also a way we stand up for ourselves, like, that really speaks to me.
Yes, absolutely. Feeling our feelings, which, thank you, Andrea Landry, because I keep saying it, I keep thinking it. It's what's getting me through a lot of my feelings these days, the importance of that. And when we do feel our feelings, we feel liberated. We're more free.
Yeah, and that liberation can and will be political. So it's like, you know, sitting outside crying, maybe we can start to see that as a first act of political liberation. If you'd like to follow Andrea Landry and learn more about her work, go to Instagram at Indigenous Motherhood or Twitter at Andrea Landry One. We'll link to these accounts in our show notes. And for member content next week, members will get our reoccurring series on what is bringing me and Angela comfort right now, and more from our conversation with Andrea, where we talk about what traditional kinship practices can look like, even while parenting during a pandemic. Don't forget to go to thedoubleshift.com/join to become a member. It starts at $5 a month, and if you're able to pay by the year, that helps us even more. Remember, Double Shift members get an ad-free show and weekly episodes. We can't make this show without you. If you haven't already, make sure you're following us on Instagram. It's where we share articles, photos of our guests we feature on the show, plus hot takes you need on motherhood from me and Angela. You can find us at The Double Shift. The Double Shift is created and hosted by me, Catherine Goldstein. Our co-host is Angela Garbez. Our senior producer is Rachel McCarthy. We are also produced by Asal Asanipour. Our editor is Anita Rao. Our research assistant is Jada Hester. Music is by Travis Morrison and Blue Dot Sessions. Our theme song is by Palehound. Our mixer is Corey Schreffel. We're funded in part by the generous support of the Ford Foundation and you, our members. We can't do this without you. Go to thedoubleshift.com/join to become a member. We are independently produced and distributed. Thanks for being part of The Double Shift.